Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you this 20th of March, 2011, here in WILL AM 580. We're going to be talking about the economy in today's program and the coverage of our news media of the economic crisis, the financial crisis, and the nature of our economy in general. And we're going to be talking with the editor of a brand new book and a longtime journalist, Anya Shiffrin, joining us today on the phones for the full hour, so be sure to join us. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minute.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
I'm Fraley Nord.
AT&T's broadband customers will soon be squeezed for more charges on their bills. The company is imposing data caps, 150 gigabytes for DSL service and 250 gigabytes for UVerse subscribers. Internet users will have to pay an additional $10 for each 50 gigabyte increment over the cap. AT&T said that the caps are necessary to address congestion in the network. But Free Press Research Director Derek Turner says that AT&T's internet overcharging is a very poor solution to an unproven problem.
There's simply no reason AT&T has economically for metering their services and penalizing consumers for using more of their services. There's no congestion problem that's been proven.
Turner says that increasing popularity of services like Netflix and Hulu show that consumers are clamoring for better choices than their cable TV provider.
But if AT&T starts making customers look at the meter and look over their shoulder, consumers are going to be unwilling to experiment with these services. So this is a very dangerous and unnecessary move that is basically going to ensure that companies like AT&T and Comcast were able to kill the emerging online video industry in the crib before it even has a chance to take hold and to get started.
Former FCC Chairman Michael Powell was named head of the nation's largest cable lobby, the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. Powell headed the FCC from 2001 to 2005. He'll take the reins of the NCTA from President and CEO Kyle Mixlero on April 25th. Comcast President Brian Roberts says he's thrilled with Powell's new position, but Free Press had a different take. The Media Watchdog's managing director, Craig Aaron.
This appointment pretty much epitomizes everything that's wrong with policymaking in Washington. You know, here we have a public servant who sees no problem with just a few years after leaving office becoming the head of one of the biggest and most powerful lobbies in Washington. But we really shouldn't be surprised. This was a chairman who pursued policies that benefited the cable industry while he was in office, and now he's been set up with perhaps the ultimate payback, a multi-million dollar salary, a nice office, and an official title as working for the cable industry.
A good story can cross generations, continents, and ideological borders. That's the lesson Boston-based youth media organization PressPass TV tries to teach, focusing on storytelling that engages the commonalities of its listeners. Co-producer Kara Lisa Berg Powers.
It really connects people who might share the same values to the stories and how they impact people directly. So when we work with young people to create storytelling messages, we're able to give them the tools that they need to connect people who might not understand their experiences to their stories.
At PressPass TV in Boston, Powers collaborates with youth organizations, nonprofits, and other groups to promote social awareness and change in local communities through advocacy journalism.
Essentially, our role in youth media is working with organizations that work with young people to do organizing around different social justice issues to create messages that help them in their work.
PressPass TV partnered with the organization Sociedad Latina to create an informative video where teenagers address the impact of teachers who lacked a certain understanding of others' customs.
It's a lot more compelling for a teenager to say, you know, I've had teachers tell me that my accent's too thick and that made me feel dumb, than to say it's important to have cultural competency training. When you actually see the impacts that it's had on people and connect to the humanity that we all share, then we're able to actually make our values more approachable.
At PressPass TV, young people are given tools to make political change in their communities. In a successful campaign called Youth Way on the MBTA, a collaboration with the Roxbury Environmental Empowerment Project and the Boston Area Youth Organizing Project, supporters pushed to extend the train's youth pass until 11 p.m. for those with after-school jobs and activities.
Not only did they get that win, There are still several others that they're still working on, and they're building a national movement around youth transportation justice. The piece that we created was on Manhattan Neighborhood Network and has helped to connect them to organizations working for transportation justice with youth in New York City.
Powers will join other engaging and thoughtful activists, educators, and media makers at the 2011 National Conference for Media Reform. Please visit conference.freepress.net for more information.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 20th, 2011. Here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Anya Shiffrin. She's the Director of Media and Communications Program at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Anya Shiffrin's been a reporter for the PAF for a long time and spent 10 years working overseas as a journalist in Europe and Asia, writing for a number of publications, including the Wall Street Journal and working for the Dow Jones Newswires. She's the editor of a brand new book, Bad News: How America's Business Press Missed the Story of the Century, just out by New Press, and I've had the privilege of reading this book. Anya Shiffrin, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, you are an international reporter, you're a foreign correspondent for many years, and I gather you've just returned from Japan. So before we get into the press coverage of the economic and financial problems of the last few years, maybe you can just give us an update. How long were you in Japan? What can you tell us from what you saw there that we might not be getting in the TV reports we see?
Yeah, sure. Well, I went to Japan last week. I just missed the earthquake, and after it happened, I made sure that I didn't go near Tokyo. So I went for a Columbia conference that, of course, got canceled. But it was very interesting being there during this time. The Japanese people that I met were very sort of stoic and even apologetic and actually apologized to us repeatedly for the inconvenience caused by the earthquake. People were not necessarily overtly emotional in conversations with us, but everybody was glued to the TV. And there was, as you can imagine, there was blanket coverage on the official broadcaster, NHK. One thing that caught my attention was that all the government officials donned blue sort of workers' uniforms as they were speaking at press conferences and making announcements as a way of sort of showing how serious they were. So you had all these people in the sort of blue uniforms, a bit like how our presidents take off their ties when they go visit the troops.
Yeah, or George Bush in that famous scene was wearing the military garb.
Exactly.
A mission accomplished.
That's right. That's right. So they all wore, everybody, you know, wore their blue uniforms, and the Japanese all said to us, you know, this is a sign that they're serious. And interestingly, we've actually started a study with my students and with a British professor called Heido Lugo about New York Times coverage. We're comparing it to Guardian coverage of natural disasters. And we looked last fall, a few of my students looked at coverage of the earthquakes in Haiti and Chile, the floods in Pakistan, and Hurricane Katrina. And what they found, which is absolutely what we've seen with the New York Times, is how after a few days, as reporters look for sort of, you know, fifth-day stories, the coverage often turns to a kind of examination of the role of the state. So in places like Haiti and Pakistan, we saw a lot of coverage about how the state had failed, mm-hmm. obviously in the U.S. with George Bush and during Katrina. And I've seen that also with the New York Times coverage of Japan. It's now being turned into a sort of general critique of the political system and the fact that there's so much consensus there. The government is being sort of accused of, you know, paralysis because of their system and the state unable to handle the responsibility and of what's actually going on. So that was something that was kind of true to form. I guess even the most avid small government proponents, when there's a natural disaster, suddenly realize that there actually is a role for government intervention.
Was there much discussion of just the notion of nuclear energy or nuclear power and its future in Japan, or is it too early for that discussion to really take place?
I think it's probably pretty early, although it seems to be happening. What it seemed to me in Japan was that the Japanese were slower to consider the radiation problem the first couple of days and more just focused on the earthquake. So So, you know, friends in Europe and the U.S. were sort of saying this is it for nuclear power, but the Japanese were still trying to come to grips with the day-to-day realities of what was going on there. But certainly from the beginning, we did hear skepticism expressed by Japanese friends saying they were worried about the radiation and they felt that, you know, the situation was probably worse than the government was saying. But I would say that the coverage in Japan in general was more restrained than some of the television coverage here. You certainly didn't see, you know, pictures of dead or injured on Japanese television. By and large.
Now, Anya Shiffrin, you also were in Egypt, if I'm not mistaken, prior to the uprising?
Yeah, that was funny. We were there. We were actually in Tunisia a year ago, and then we were in Egypt in January, again, for a couple of conferences. And we were there the day that Ben Ali left Tunisia. And it was quite extraordinary because it was announced at the dinner that we were at in Cairo, and the whole room burst into applause and started chanting, "Us next, us next." We could see the social tension. That was very clear in Egypt. People were sort of complaining about each other quite a bit. You know, the cops were expressing fear of violence, and some of the academics and we met also said that the discussion about politics had really opened up there in the last decade, and while that was welcome, they were sometimes a little bit afraid. I did meet with quite a number of young journalists and some people working in online, and their frustration with the old order was very, very clear. There was such a feeling of kind of frustration and exhaustion, and it's time for these old people in the government to step aside and let all of us build a new country. So that was clear, but I can't say that I knew what was going to happen.
Now, have you been to Egypt or Tunisia, you know, 5-10 years ago? Have you had any history in that region to get a sense of how things had changed?
The previous time I'd been in Egypt was in the 80s, and obviously it was a very, very different country. When we were in Tunisia a year ago, it felt that things had really deteriorated. They had a bit of a sort of social contract before the Ben Ali. I don't want to, you know, in some ways it was sort of like a Lee Kuan Yew, Kemal Ataturk sort of arrangement of you're not going to have much human, you know, Singapore, that were not, there was sort of a nanny state in a way. And the arrangement was like China, which is you're not going to have a huge amount of freedom or free expression, but we will deliver economically. And clearly, you know, this is obviously everyone knows this now, but it was very clear that what had happened in Tunisia over the last couple of years was that the corruption of the ruling family, especially the Trabelsis, the Ben Ali's wife, had really started to frustrate people. And they felt, you know, we're not only do we have no freedom of expression, but we're not even getting economic growth. And unemployment was a growing problem. That change was obvious.
Hey, the reason I asked that is that in 1973, to date myself, I spent quite a bit of time in Iran, which then was a police state under the Shah.
Yeah.
And no one ever would talk about politics. I mean, it was simply, it really was a chilling effect throughout the society. But it was also palpable how much the government was despised by people, that, you know, but no one would say it. So I was not surprised at all 6 years later when he was overthrown.
That's really interesting. That was exactly in Tunisia. People were too afraid to talk about politics with us. In Egypt, as you say, it had changed, and people were much more open about their anger. Yeah.
Our guest, Anya Shiffrin from Columbia University, editor of the brand new book, Bad News, How America's Business Press Missed the Story of the Century. And in your earlier incarnation, Anya Shiffrin, you were a business journalist. You covered the Asian financial crisis in the 90s. You've covered a lot of global economic issues. We're going to talk about that book. Now, people have questions or comments they'd like to make to Professor Shiffrin. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455 or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Anya Shiffrin, why this book? What was your motivation for putting this book together?
Well, interestingly, it does sort of begin with the Asian crisis. I was in Hanoi from 97 to 99 working for Dow Jones and writing a bit for the Wall Street Journal. And as soon as the Vietnamese government realized that they had a banking crisis, they dealt with it by making the Politburo passed a law making it illegal to write about banking. And journalists obviously were really kind of stuck during the Asian crisis. Many of them had never, you know, no one had ever seen anything like that before, especially the Vietnamese journalists. We didn't have the internet. There was no way of getting outside information. And it was really kind of difficult to know what was going on and what the right solutions were. So when the U.S. financial crisis started, I was very interested to see, would journalists be under more pressure? Would they feel sort of compelled to hold back a little bit and not talk about how bad things were or how bad things were going to get? And then, of course, my colleague Dean Starkman from Columbia Journalism Review in the audit started writing these articles about the track record of the press and the run-up to the crisis and, you know, the stories that had been missed.
Yeah, he was quite critical, and you've got a chapter by Starkman in the book.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, Dean feels that before the crisis happened, there was some isolated investigative work, but that there wasn't enough, and that it wasn't coherent and cohesive. It didn't hang together, and that in general, I think the press was too enamored. He talks about magazines like Fortune that were just sort of too enamored of the CEO culture, and gave them too much slack. Enamored by finance, it's a very hard. Jim Ledbetter has pointed out recently to me, it's a very hard thing to measure, this question of should the press have done a better job, because how do you define sort of what is a good job and what's enough coverage? And if there's stories on the back pages of the Wall Street Journal but not on the front page, does that mean there wasn't enough warning? But I think there's no question that business journalists do have a very hard time, because what they cover is so technical. And therefore, they often don't have enough knowledge to actually see what's coming and what is going on. I don't necessarily want to single out business journalists, because, of course, economists, regulators, and people in finance didn't know either most of the time what was happening. Finance has spent years trying to come up with really complicated derivatives that no one could understand, and the result was no one could understand them.
Well, no less than the Queen of England, if I'm not mistaken, convened many of the leading economists of Britain together and said, how do you guys miss this? It's not that the smartest people knew it and weren't sharing it. It's oftentimes the very smartest people by our standards were the most adrift.
That's right. And as you know, there's now this movement that George Soros is helping fund, INET, Institute for New Economic Thinking, where a lot of the economists are getting together and talking about how to change the profession. I think that one of the points I make in my book is journalists are always dependent on sources, but when something's really, really technical, you become more dependent on your sources. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really part of the story here. I'm sure you remember that wonderful study by Herb Gans, where he spent several years in various newsrooms and sort of watched how journalists chose who they interviewed and who they quoted in their stories. And he talks about how journalists who cover specific agencies or beats, like someone who's at the Pentagon every day or who covers the World Bank, he describes it as becoming ambassadors. And I think that's exactly what happens, is you spend so much time trying to explain to your editor, what exactly the World Bank is doing and explaining it to your readers, that in a certain sense you become really you start to identify with your sources.
Sort of like a capture regulator, you become a capture journalist?
Yes, some people call it exactly cognitive capture. That's what Financial Times, the editor of the U.S. edition, Gillian Tett, refers to it, is cognitive capture. And it's not necessarily... sometimes it's overt. Sometimes business journalists really do start to believe that the people, they cover in finance and in business know more than everyone else. And sometimes it's not so overt as much, as more just sort of having their worldview really, really shaped. When I started at Dow Jones, I didn't get any training in how to cover markets. I was handed a source list, and I called traders all day long. And the traders were the people that educated me about how the markets worked. So I was sort of naturally inculcated with their worldview. And I think that happens to a lot of sort of younger, less experienced journalists. I think we're also very lucky because there's people like the Financial Times columnist Martin Wolf, who has a PhD in economics. There are people like Floyd Norris, Gretchen Morgenson at the New York Times. So there are some very strong journalists who do have a deep grasp of economics and, a good degree of skepticism. But you've written in your books about how much more dependent media outlets are today on the wire reporting or the press releases, and obviously increased dependence on press releases or stories that have only one or two sources is going to lead to a poorer quality of information about business and finance.
Our guest today, Anya Shiffrin, editor of the new book, Bad News, How America's Business Press Missed the Story of the Century, just out by New Press, a collection of a number of essays, including work by herself, including an essay by Dean Starkman from Columbia's Journalism School, she referred to, by Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel laureate economist, has a piece, an original piece in the volume, too, that's well worth reading, and several other articles as well, going through the nature of the coverage and giving a couple of strong case studies from California and Britain as well. As I said, the book just out now. Yeah, one of the things that struck me, Anya Shiffrin, as I was reading the book, was that, you know, there's really two different types of journalism that cover capitalism, that cover the economy. There's the business press, which is aimed at generally very affluent people who have money to invest, as a rule, and businesses. And then there's sort of the general news that the rest of us get, for the most part. And much of the coverage of the economic crisis begins with and percolates with the financial press or the business press. This is, you know, this is where the story is really covered for the most part. But as your book points out, there are tensions in there on sort of the pressures that those journalists specifically are going to have that aren't going to necessarily be there as a rule for other types of journalists. Is that a fair assessment?
What specifically, what kinds of pressures?
Well,
are you
in about? That they're, since, well, for one thing, they're dealing specifically with a market of investors. So their approach to it is going to be very much from the vantage point of how this affects investors. And there's going to be tremendous incentive to see that the system work or an assumption that it work. And a great fear of promoting the idea of catastrophe, that leading to bad psychology.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I sometimes think that it's almost unrealistic for us to expect, say, business and financial reporters to cover the economy in a way that's appropriate for general readers. As you know, business journalism started in the 16th century with sort of newsletters in places like Venice and Antwerp and shipping lists. I've actually been reading some 18th and 19th century Indian newspapers and looking at the very early British business coverage, and it was always aimed, the history of sort of business journalism was basically always aimed at investors. So there, it was never meant to sort of explain economics or explain business to ordinary readers. It's a sort of mini environment of its own. It's its own ecosystem, which has its own sort of language and rules. And I had a very interesting and wonderful time at Dow Jones, and I was never told not to write anything. But it was understood that the only thing that our only criteria really for news was, is it going to be market moving? Is it going to affect the profitability of the companies that we cover? So I was able to write about labor stories or peasant uprisings in Vietnam by saying it could have an effect, a larger economic effect, or it could affect the business I was writing about. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it wasn't considered important. So we were never really supposed to write about normal people and their concerns or how, you know, governments' political decisions would affect average people or the we didn't do consumer stories. We only did them if it might affect a company's profitability or perhaps the CPI, the consumer price index for a country. So it's a sort of a narrow world. And I think that what's been interesting about the press coverage during this recent crisis is that it's taken a lot of the economic stories and put them on the front page. And when you're a sort of business reporter toiling away in the business section, it can be so frustrating not to have a more general following. But during this crisis, we saw people like Peter Goodman. There was some flowering of great reporting that took place. And so people like Peter Goodman all of a sudden were able to write about normal people losing their jobs, being foreclosed on, and getting that on the front page of the New York Times. But that, I would say, is the exception.
You know, in the book, the subtitle of the book is How the Business Press Missed the Story of the Century. What were the big parts of the story they missed? What was missing? And let's start with prior to September 2008, when you had the financial meltdown. You know, what were the stories that we needed to know that we weren't hearing about?
Well, Mike Hudson, obviously the subprime, sort of depth and seriousness of the whole subprime was a crucial topic. And interestingly, Mike Hudson has been writing about that for probably something like 15 years. But again, it gets back to that question. It was out there, but it was largely ignored. So when there was legislation passed against sort of predatory pricing and subprime, and sub, not subprime, but some of the predatory lending that was going on, which, again, Dean Starkman is right about, there was sort of a flurry of press coverage, and then it was submerged. There was certainly coverage about the, you know, the real estate market, and is it a bubble, and is it going to burst? But I think there wasn't an understanding of how exposed some of our hugest banks, you know, and AIG actually were to these kinds of instruments. Gretchen Morgenson wrote pretty early on about Fannie and Freddie, but obviously a lot of people didn't. So I would say those were some of the questions. And then once the crisis started, there was just a lot of very confusing macroeconomic coverage. You probably had the same feeling I did of picking up the paper and not really understanding what on earth the jobless numbers meant, or were we in a recovery or not. Do you remember green shoots?
Vaguely.
You know, all of a sudden, the government sort of said things are getting better. We
see
green
yeah.
shoots. And then you had, was that 2008 or 2009? Then you had all the sort of flurry of reports saying, yes, 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 the economy is getting better, when it really wasn't.
Well, let's back up, because one of the stories that comes up in the book, one of the things I think is most interesting is for a brief moment, for about 48 hours in September 2008, there was sort of a general understanding or awareness that maybe getting rid of the New Deal era regulations of the financial system, specifically the Glass-Steagall Act, but a number of other regulations associated with that, which limited the ability of financial chicanery and speculation, that getting rid of those in the 1990s, 80s and 90s, but especially 1990s, had contributed greatly to the wild growth of speculation and finance and the bubble. And that was just a very brief moment where they're sort of generally recognized. It's long since been forgotten, pretty much. But as you point out in the book, when Glass-Steagall was repealed, which was the great New Deal Act to put strict restrictions on the banking system so it wouldn't lead to a depression like it had assisted in 1929, 30, 31, it got covered by the news media. Like, if you were opposed to repealing Glass-Steagall, that was sort of like being in the Flat Earth Society. I mean, there was no debate, was there, at that time?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, no, I remember, because I was actually covering finance for the Industry Standard at that time. And there was always, every time anyone referred to Glass-Steagall, they would call it Depression-era legislation. And there wasn't enough discussion about the implications. I remember writing a couple stories saying that it would lead to consolidation in the banking sector, and that would erode the quality of lending, which exactly is what happened. I can't, you know, claim to be any great genius. I interviewed people who pointed that out, but there wasn't a lot of coverage at that time. You're absolutely right. Similarly, the absolute sort of lionization of Alan Greenspan, where for years journalists didn't write critical pieces about him. And remember, he was the maestro. And,
oh, yeah. In the 1990s, he was like Mick Jagger.
That's right. That's right. So he was sort of praised. And then when the sort of downfall, I talk in the book about tracing the press coverage of the sort of downfall of his reputation. His memoirs came out, and Bob Sola wrote a sort of critical piece about it for the New Republic. And then after that, there were more and more. I remember the Financial Times, more and more pieces used the memoir. Journalists used the memoir as a peg. And I think the final sort of final straw was Peter Goodman's front page piece in the New York Times about him. And that really made it feel like, okay, now it's conventional wisdom that he messed up. One of the interesting things that's happened since the book has come out is that I've been hearing from journalists telling me about stories they tried to write and which their editors wouldn't let them write. And one of them was a journalist, I think in 2005, tried to write a critical piece about Greenspan. And like the movie The Player, it got turned into a piece about what a great operator he was.
That is clear. That's just 2005. That's not very long ago.
No, it's not.
You know, Anya Shiffrin, one of the things when I read your book, and this comes up in the book, is that there are some economists, noted economists, who, you know, were aware of these problems and publicizing them and talking about them. And I think James Galbraith is one.
Yeah.
Dean Baker, who, you know, accurately diagnosed and discussed the housing bubble and the financial bubble. Going back to the very beginning, I mean, a decade ago, coming out of the high-tech bubble, and wrote about it intelligently. And so it wasn't like there weren't accomplished economist and writing in plain English in simple terms, making fairly credible arguments that historically what was taking place in the last decade was not sustainable, was not tenable for the economy, yet they were entirely ignored. And if I can finish the story, they were briefly paid attention to for 48 hours in 2008 when they were congratulated for being prescient. And now they're ignored again, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the problems, obviously, is that journalists tend to write about what's already happened, and they don't like to go out on a limb and predict what is going to happen. So we actually did a LexisNexis search of some of the economists who predicted the crisis, such as Robert Shiller, Noriel Roubini, my husband Joe Stiglitz, and you're absolutely right that what their predictions were weren't really covered. They were barely interviewed on those subjects, and then after the crisis started, there was a sort of flurry of press coverage. And we also did a study year before last of 750 articles about the stimulus, the economic stimulus, and I'm hoping that will be published next year. I've submitted it to an academic journal, and it was the same thing. I don't want to say the coverage was terrible, but it in no way set the agenda or led the debate. It wasn't until sort of the July after the Recovery Act was passed that we started to see stories about whether or not it was going to work, and that was because the unemployment rate was continuing to rise, and so many journalists concluded that it wasn't working. But before it was passed, nearly all the stories were sort of blow-by-blow, spot news, political stories, you know, will it pass, won't it pass, what will it take, who's holding out. There wasn't really very much sort of deep analysis of the stimulus. And of course, I think that because journalism, all the things you've written about, the pressure that journalists are under now, the job losses, the financial pressure, I think, there's two repercussions. One is that newspapers, magazines are understaffed. People don't have the time to really delve deeply. And the other thing is I think people get scared. You know, if they know they may lose their job, there's a tendency to sort of hunker down and go with what your editor wants and the sort of tried and true coverage, I think. I don't know if that's something you've noticed.
Well, I think you're right. Our guest today is Anya Shiffrin, the editor of the new book, Bad News, How America's Press Missed the Story of the Century, an edited collection, the number of extraordinary contributors. Anya Shiffrin, director of the Media and Communications Program at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. If folks would like to call in to talk with our guests, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm surprised there isn't more action on the phones. This is supposed to be a hot topic, but I guess we're nerve-wracked by the other stories of the day. I wanted to mention also that Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot's argument about the phony crisis in Social Security never gets a nod, and it's very salient because it looks like that's still on the docket for, and the arguments around it aren't that complicated, but they're just completely ignored. But I wanted to ask you about Inside Job. I don't know if documentaries that win the Academy Award are on as few screens as it seems to be. It hasn't come here yet. I've heard an interview with the author just from the Commonwealth Club yesterday on this air, and some astonishing vignettes and stories in it. And it just seems that we need that kind of phenomenon to inform the debate more and get some light out there. So I don't know if you have any reflections on that in particular. He seemed to be embarrassed to say, make a political statement after getting the documentary award about how there's no one in jail. Now, there is this insider trading story that I've heard about, but I don't think it's widely being reported on. And I think that as well as everything else that's been going on, insider information, whether it's about who's buying the derivatives, betting against that corporation or betting against that phenomena, that stuff, which doesn't have to be revealed on any kind of brokerage house, is when that does get released to people, that's basically some more insider information, and it seems like the whole structure of finance is now built on that kind of thing. So that's not a very coherent question.
Well, actually, Those are great questions.
Absolutely.
And let me just say before I hand it over to you, Anya Schifrin, that you address those issues in the book. They all come up. And if I can just take the last part, because I want to go back to Social Security in a second, but before we get to Social Security, which is mentioned in the book.
I'll take Inside Job.
The one I want to ask you about that is this comes up in the book, and it was on my list of questions. Matt Taibbi and Robert Scheer both have written book-length treatments similar to Inside Job of the financial crisis, and really a lot of the criminality, not just corruption, that took place, has taken place. And not in full wholesale corruption of historic proportions at the same time. And these are journalists, Taibbi, Robert Scheer. They've been on this show. Scheer is, in fact, going to be on 2 weeks to talk about that. And, why is it authors like Taibbi and Scheer, freelancers or writing for Rolling Stone, who do books that are covering these stories or Inside Job, a documentary, and when you see that film or when you read their books, I mean, their mouths fall open. They can't believe what they're reading. Why isn't this all over our news every day?
Yeah. Well, those were all really good questions. I thought the caller raised some very interesting points. I remember after Enron giving a talk in Hanoi, and I was asked before I went there to talk about Enron. That's what people wanted to hear about. So I gave this presentation, and the two questions at the end were, how many people have been arrested? And why didn't your Ministry of Industry prevent this from happening? So I very much agree with you that the fact that these guys, aren't in jail and have been allowed to get away with it is unbelievable. And when you see films like Inside Job and you read work by people like Matt Taibbi, it's shocking. Perhaps part of why they were able to do what they did was they weren't covering these things day to day, and so they weren't embroiled in that little sort of ecosystem that I was talking about that some sort of journalists get into. I thought that Inside Job was an incredibly powerful movie, which really implicated so many people. It took I don't know if the caller saw this film American Casino by Coburn. That was on the subprime, the effect that the subprime foreclosures had in Baltimore. That was a very powerful movie. And Inside Job even took that a little bit further and looked at sort of the theoretical failures of the economics profession as well as all the dirty dealings on Wall Street. It's leading, you've probably seen, to more soul-searching. Just as journalists have sort of done their share of soul-searching, so are some of the economists. And so there's now a lot of talk in the economics profession about whether economists themselves should disclose who hires them as consultants. One of the most powerful moments of Inside Job was about an economist who wrote a report before the crash in Iceland saying that things were fine, and the report had actually been commissioned by the Iceland Chamber of Commerce. So people are talking more now about whether, just like scientists are supposed to disclose who's funding their research, whether economists now have to start disclosing things like that. But it's a fantastic movie, and I'm sorry it hasn't arrived where you are yet, because it's really worth seeing.
But I want to go back to this question. If Taibbi and Robert Scheer in his book, An Inside Job, I mean, the evidence here seems, if not incontrovertible, certainly so powerful it demands attention. At what point is it an obligation of a business or financial journalist covering this beat who's aware of this to say, okay, these are unanswered questions. Even though no one I'm talking to as my sources wants to talk about this stuff for obvious reasons, as a journalist, I have an obligation to keep this story alive.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I think there's definitely a tendency in journalism to sort of say, well, we've done that, or someone else has done it. So it's been done. It's out there. I don't need to follow up. No, I absolutely agree.
And then that leads to the follow-up to that, which is, last year we had the big debate over the financial regulatory reform package from the Obama administration that was passed in Congress. And there's a wide range of opinion on how much reform that was and how effective it will be. But there's certainly a considerable body of opinion that thinks that by not getting the banks to be smaller and not really reinstituting strong regulations, we might be back in the same boat we've been in 2007, 2008 down the road. There aren't necessarily enough safeguards. I don't know if you agree with that, but I mean, how good of a job do you think journalism or journalism has done covering that debate in Congress and sort of getting the issues out in play so that people understand what's going on there?
Well, I think I agree with you generally that it felt like there was this moment when sort of real reform could happen, and then it just felt like that moment passed. And I'm still sitting here like you wondering what exactly happened. The deficit, you know, Social Security, as the caller pointed out, the deficit is another example. You know, a year ago, everybody supposedly was agreed that we needed stimulus. Now, all of a sudden, everyone's saying that the deficit's the problem. Absolutely, the financial regulation's been watered down. I mean, there are still some people that are talking about it, like on the blogs, and people like, you know, Gretchen Morgenstern, who aren't letting it drop. But I agree with you that the press has let a lot of this drop.
You know, one of the ironies of, and I think you know this from your understanding of economics, one of the ironies of the financial deregulation is the other great sort of liberal or Keynesian notion that helped explain the depression, and that sort of was resurrected for about 48 hours in 2008, is that in the 1920s, the United States, there was a massive increase of economic inequality, and money was flowing to the top, and there wasn't enough money in the hands of average people to buy stuff. And that combined with financial debt stimulated the depression. And we had the same process in the United States for the last two or three decades, as I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with. Yet that whole discussion of economic inequality has really not returned to sort of the economic debate at all, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I think there was a little spate of coverage.
Yeah, that 48-hour
exactly
window.
Exactly, recently, yeah. Because of that new study came out. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are terrifying.
But is that something, I mean, that's an economic issue outside of the morality of it. You know, this is simply something economists have talked about as being a factor that accounts for stagnation and depressions, is that people can't buy stuff.
Yeah.
But that doesn't show up in our journalism covering the economy.
Yeah, I think it's, again, we need to make those distinctions between who's covering it and who isn't. So you would expect that to be covered by people like the New York Times, but not necessarily by, you know, Bloomberg or some specialized financial service.
Oh, really? Because the people that Bloomberg writes for are trying to sell products, and if no one has money to buy them, that's a business issue.
Yeah. No, you're right. Absolutely.
And then we should get to the second half of the caller's question, or the first half, which was Social Security, because you do write about that in the book. And the sort of the way that issue is being covered now, what's your sense?
It's obviously really hard to know what's going to happen. I guess I'm pessimistic about everything at the moment. It feels like Obama's not able to get a lot of things through. And the Republicans are really setting the agenda on so much of this. But it's been interesting at the same time that the polls, such as in Wisconsin, do suggest that there is support for programs like Social Security. So I'm not really sure how it's going to play out.
Our guest is Anya Shiffrin. You've just been listening to Anya Shiffrin is the director of the Media and Communications Program at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. She's also the editor of the brand new book, Bad News, How America's Business Press Missed the Story of the Century, just out by New Press. We've been talking with her. We do have phone lines open at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, I was interested by your discussion of the financial regulation bills passed last session, and I was surprised that you didn't make any mention of the current effort underway by the Republicans to actually weaken those even further. And I've been looking for more news about those in the media and seeing very little discussion of that, and was surprised that y'all didn't discuss that at all.
All right, well, thank you very much, caller. Anya Shiffrin?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you raised that. Where do you tend to look for your news?
I think our callers usually hang up after the question to free up the lines. But I would think the assumption we might make is just standard news diet of cable television and maybe the New York Times.
Yeah, because I do feel now that it's incumbent upon all of us to spend a lot of time digging and supplementing the sort of basics with the blogs, Huffington Post, Politico, Naked Capitalism, Credit Write Down, and some of these other websites. So it's a lot of work, but I agree, it's you're not going to find the really interesting stories on TV, that's for sure.
But I mean, the point the caller's getting to that is sort of a really interesting political question is that the Republicans right now, in general, if not in mass, are trying to deregulate, I don't know what the term is, trying to basically get rid of any regulation and even go to further deregulation than we had prior to 2008, if I'm not mistaken. And it seems that that's striking, and I don't know how well understood that is. And maybe that's the fault of people who can't go to 68 different websites, but shouldn't something that important be understood by someone who only has 10 minutes a day to look at news media?
Yes, definitely. There's no question about that. But again, I think you've documented so well in your work that in a country where people are watching a lot of television and television news is so weak, I was just reading last night some of your essays talking about how sort of television news and radio news and all of these outlets have become kind of, you know, worse and worse over the years. I'm afraid that a lot of those really important stories aren't getting covered in mainstream media.
And what can we do? Your book, I think, has recommendations. It has some sort of optimism, might be too strong a word, but certainly it's not a just simply doing an autopsy. You strike out and you know, mention the good stuff, and there are recommendations. What do you think can be done to improve the situation?
Yeah, well, what we've got at the end is a chapter more aimed at journalists about how they can write, how they can do better coverage. And a lot of that is things like, you know, get a more diverse form of sources, look skeptically at what you're being told, really try to delve deep and talk to a range of economists and experts. Don't just talk to people in finance. So I think for journalists, there's a lot that can be done to strengthen coverage. For normal people, I feel like that's something that's going to be discussed quite a lot at your conference in April, what advocates can do. And, you know, I saw again, that in some of your writing, you've been sort of pessimistic about some of the solutions that people have held out as hopes, which is, you know, more foundation funding and more, more money and support for alternative forms of media. So pessimistic, though I think you may be about this, I'm not sure that we have anything else, because I don't think this country's government is about to start supporting press, even though they probably should.
Well, you know, that does lead to another question I had, which is, in the book, I think you make a pretty powerful case that, you know, there's severe flaws because of sources and structure and ownership that sort of limit what financial and business reporters, if not political reporters, can do is they cover the economic crisis. And it does lead one to wonder, do other countries that have a large public sector, like BBC, for example, in Britain, and it's true all across Europe and Asia, and you see it in Japan, does that present a different type of business coverage, or does it really irrelevant whether it's run by a commercial operation or a public operation?
Yeah, well, there is an essay in our book arguing that the British press has a much longer tradition of sort of intelligent coverage on economics, and that sort of dates back the past 100 years. I often like to say that business coverage is almost the fifth column on every newspaper. I've spent a fair bit of time doing journalism training in less developed countries. So I've been working with reporters in places like Vietnam, Mongolia, China, different parts of Ghana, South Africa, on business coverage. And what I do find is that very often business journalists sort of take on, again, it's sort of back to cognitive capture, do take on the ideology of their sources.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say in the countries where I've worked that business journalism is necessarily better here at all. To the contrary. And I think it's even harder. One of the things I hope this isn't too far afield, but one of the things we've been looking at is press coverage in Ghana, Uganda, Nigeria of oil and mining companies. And that is not in some cases, there's been some good examples of sort of investigative and watchdog reporting, but in general, that's not the role the press is playing.
We have one more caller on your show, but before we get to that caller, I want to make sure you answer this one question I had that just jumped out at me as I read the book.
Please.
Which is, when we cover business and talk about sources, we talk about the economy. The economy is always framed in terms of investors and firms and businesses, as the stock market and various other markets. But it hasn't always been that way. I remember growing up in the 1960s, and when the economy was covered, as often as not, you might hear the head of the UAW or the AFL-CIO or someone representing organized labor is actually having a credible statement to make about economic policy. It seems, I read your book, it seemed like labor has almost disappeared. You wouldn't even know we had organized labor in the United States.
That's absolutely right.
It's just not there at all.
No, that's absolutely true. I used to teach a class at Columbia, in fact, on covering labor, and it's obviously something that I used to write about in Vietnam. I mean, economic coverage obviously is much broader, and it includes things like unemployment figures and trade. So I would say that the economic coverage is often broader than the business coverage. I would make that distinction. But you're absolutely right that labor reporting is pretty much gone now. Very few newspapers have labor reporters or even legal reporters anymore. And so much of the coverage, even in, you know, we have Steengreen House, thank God, at the New York Times, but, you know, so much of the coverage is not investigative reporting per se. It's leaks from lawyers or government agencies that have already done the work. So.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now too. Someone has been waiting patiently. Line one, Decatur, you're on the air with Anya Schifrin.
Yeah, good afternoon. It seems like to me the underlying situation here is a class warfare. You've got big business has been oppressing labor and going after labor every step of the way since the 1930s. You've got tremendous amounts of wealth transfer. They didn't have to transfer the wealth from the middle class to the gamblers on Wall Street. And you have the Republicans onslaught out after onslaught to try and erode anything for, you know, collective bargaining and erode the benefits for the middle of class, going down to try and knock out the public Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So what is the end game? Well, I guess I'd like to have you reflect on that and give me your thoughts as to, okay, where do we wind up? A third world nation that have a lot of poor people and a lot of rich people, and why would they want to do that? So I'll listen to what you have to in your comments about that.
Anya Schifrin?
Yeah, I do worry a lot that we're going to end up like a third world nation. I think in terms of social mobility, we're already well behind Europe, which Americans always thought of as the place that was less mobile. In terms of income inequality, we're well behind Europe. So, yeah, I worry a huge amount about that. Absolutely.
You know, and to go back to the topic of your book, and that's sort of what I was getting at with the labor question, a reporter covering the economy, especially a political reporter, not someone writing for investors in the Wall Street Journal or Forbes or something. At what point is the obligation the journalist got to cover the economy from the perspective of the 98% of the population that doesn't really have any stock holdings but actually works for a living?
Yeah, well, I think there are some people, I think some publications, you know, such as the New York Times, are doing that to a large extent and are doing a good job. So again, I think it depends very much, you know, who you're reading. The local newspapers in this country, as you know, have been gutted and aren't doing that kind of reporting. And television, to a large extent, either, as well, isn't either. So I think it depends very much. I think we have sort of, as you know, different, the stratification of our society is reflected in the stratification of our news consumption. So we have elites reading strong, you know, much better newspapers than people who are sitting home watching Fox TV.
Well, our phones are ringing off the hook. I wish this is a pledge drive week. Let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Anya Schifrin.
Yes. Earlier, Anna Schifrin said something about that Obama wasn't able to get very many things through and that Republicans were sort of running things with respect to attempts at reform. And I'm an enthusiastic Obama supporter, but I don't think that's the whole story. It's been very disappointing to see Obama appointing people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke to the posts that they have. They were people who were involved in our getting into this trouble in the first place. And so I think that that those appointments and certain other things that Obama has done and not done have to be incorporated into the story.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Anya Schifrin?
Yeah, no, I think so many people agree with you, absolutely. I mean, obviously he's been able to do some things that he hasn't gotten credit for, but certainly there was a lot of disappointment when those appointments were made, that's for sure.
You know, what's striking, and this again comes up in the book, is this whole debate over the budget right now and how the budget deficit is the cause of our problems and that we can't have a growing economy until we eliminate the deficit. And we can't eliminate the deficit by raising taxes on wealthy people either, which sort of really sort of ties our shoelaces together while it paints us into a corner with what the policy options are, if those are the ground rules. But our journalism, really, our business journalism, has not done a very good job of getting us outside of that sort of bind.
Yeah, I think we've been really lucky because we've had fantastic columnists who have. I mean, as you know,
true.
Bob Herbert is writing about this, it feels like, every single week.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Krugman's been weighing in as well.
That's
so
true.
It's good that those voices have been out there because Bob Herbert just, keeps talking about it. How can the economy grow if people don't have jobs? As you say, they won't even be able to buy anything.
Well, let's go to our final caller with just a little bit of time. Les Springfield, line 4, you're on the air with Anya Schifrin.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, just along the same line you were speaking of just now, there are several stories that tie into the issue of deficits, and they really haven't had much attention. I was wondering first about, you know, Bernie Sanders' claim that, you know, the Federal Reserve has transferred trillions of dollars to investment banks, and second, the suggestion that was made to the Deficit Commission under Bowles and Alan Simpson that there be a tax on financial transactions. And thirdly, how were Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson appointed to head that commission in the first place?
Well, those are great questions, and we're going to test your skills as a journalist on you to get an answer in 2 minutes.
I'm really not sure that I can. I think those are really good questions. That's right.
Well, give it your best shot for whichever part of that you'd like.
I'm sorry, Bob.
Okay, well, how about let's start with the story about the Federal Reserve Board transferring trillions to help bail out banks, the sort of different from the congressional bailout that we've heard about that the caller alluded to with Bernie Sanders making some comment about. You know, I've heard about this too, but is there fire behind that smoke? Do you know what the story is there?
No, I don't. But there was also that report recently that a lot of money was lent to European banks too before the crisis. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore that should have been a sign of what was coming. But I've seen, I don't have any great inside information, but I've also seen reports saying that a lot of the money was paid back. So it's really like with TARP. So it's really not clear to me what exactly has gone on. I'm sorry to let down our caller on this.
No, those were beefy questions.
Yeah.
No, we only do have about a minute left. And so, you know, the book has a lot in there. Is there something that we haven't talked about in the book, Anya Schifrin, that you want to make sure that listeners get to hear about?
Thank you for asking. Let's see. Well, there's an essay, in case anyone's interested, by Chris Rausch, which really defends the business press and its record, which I put in for balance. I thought that the essay by Peter Goodman, talking about the kind of coverage he did with some terrible stories of people who were foreclosed on, was a really strong piece. It's called The Quiet Crisis. We've also got a piece on the real housing crisis of Orange County and Real Housewives. So I think it's a nice kind of collection for people that are interested in this question about the financial press and the economic crisis.
Anya Schifrin, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here on Media Matters.
Thank you very much, and also thanks to all the callers.
Okay. Anya Schifrin, our guest, the editor of the new book, Bad News, just out with New Press. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, the engineer, Melissa Trentz, my producer. We'll be back 1 week from today to talk about the Googleization of everything. A wonderful show waiting for you. Until then, everyone, have a great week.